Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and oh my gosh, we've got a fabulous show today. Daniel Coyle of the Talent Code is our guest, and I have a two-page list of questions for him that I'm really hoping we get to in the hour, some of which you guys have emailed to me, so thank you so much for that. But I am looking very, very forward to picking his brain on talent and developing talent and what we as parents can do to help our kids along the pathway. So you're in for a real treat today. And I want to just remind you, the show airs live for an hour. At the end of the hour, we will go off air but continue to record as podcasts, and that podcast link will be online later today. So if we do go past the hour, I hope you'll check out the podcast to hear the remaining few minutes of the show. Before I bring Daniel Coyle on the air, I just want to remind you to please check out parentingaces.com. I have a link to the Talent Code and to Dan's blog on our reading list page, so please take a look. And if you haven't read his book yet, do not waste any more time. Pick it up. It is a quick read. It's very straightforward, very to the point, and he words the information, even though it's a lot of science, it's put to us in a way that's very simple to understand. And I promise you, I am not a science brain, so for me to say that, you'll be fine. So I'm going to bring Daniel on air in just a moment. Before I do, I want to go to a quick commercial, pay our bills for the week, and when we come back, Daniel Coyle.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to Parenting Aces on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and I'm not even going to bother introducing this guy because if you haven't read his book, well, then you need to pick it up. But if you are paying attention to Twitter and Facebook and you follow Parenting Aces, you've seen my gajillion Facebook posts and tweets over the last week in preparation for getting you ready for Daniel Coyle. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Lisa. Thanks. It's so nice to be here with you.
Are you in Alaska right now, or are you back mainland side?
I'm mainland. I'm in the lower 48, as we would call it. I'm in Ohio, east side of Cleveland, Ohio.
Awesome, awesome. Well, thank you for taking time to talk with us. I really would love to just jump right in and start spewing questions at you, but I do want to give you an opportunity to share with our listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to study the whole idea of talent and the development of talent across a lot of different areas, not just in sports.
Yeah, no, thanks, Lisa. No, I'm trained as a journalist, was a med school student for a while, and I guess I bring the interests of somebody who grew up in a very competitive family. And as a journalist, I covered a lot of high performers, you know, whether it was athletes or musicians or politicians. And the question I kept circling was, how did they get to be so good? I started to investigate this deeply. Actually, it was a tennis connection for a magazine story. I went to Spartak over in Russia, a place that's produced 11 top 20 women in the last 7 years or so. And I started to see a pattern there, a pattern of behavior, a pattern of coaching, you might say a pattern of parenting style. And looking at that, plus kind of combining it with some of the cutting-edge science that is that we're learning now about how the brain responds when it acquires skill, sort of combined into this project called The Talent Code, which is came out a while back and is still keeping me very busy, visiting military, visiting special forces, visiting sports teams, visiting businesses, and looking at really at the X-ray of what happens when somebody gets really, really good.
Well, let's delve into that a little bit, because our audience is mostly made up of parents of junior tennis players, and these parents are pretty invested in seeing their children succeed. And, you know, for those of us who have older teens and have kind of, you know, been through this process for several years already, we've seen those kids that come out of the gates winning everything at 9, 10, 11 years old. And you look at them and you think, oh my gosh, you know, I know they're supposed to put in 10,000 hours of practice. There's no way a child that age could have done that yet. What's going on that makes them so good? And then as the kids get older, you see some of the other kids start to catch up and maybe even surpass these ones that were winning everything in the younger age groups. And I know for me personally, I was confounded in the younger years and ready to just kind of throw my hands up, but have stuck with it through the advice of other parents and coaches and my son himself with his own desire to stick with it. And I'm glad we did, because he's now at that place where he's catching up. And so talk to us a little bit about the science behind all of that and what's happening in our kids' bodies and brains.
That's right. Oh, that's a great question. In a lot of ways, it's sort of the question. It has to do with the way that we think about that space. You know, conventionally, historically, culturally, we think about talent as a gift from above. You know, we think about magical little babies that are born, and it's such a beautiful story. It's an addictive story, you know, because there's these magical babies in the story. It's great. It's a very tempting and lovely idea that there are magical gifts that are distributed. And for sure, when people start out, they learn at different rates. But the picture that science is telling us, is showing us, is a very different picture than a magical gift. It's a gift. First of all, you have to understand that talent, all complex human talent, exists inside the brain. When you talk about hitting a forehand, hitting a backhand, or having a conversation like you and I are having, those exist in circuits in the brain that tell muscles what to do. And what science is showing us is that is something that takes a lot of time to build. It takes a tremendous amount of I would call deep practice when you're operating on the very edges of your ability, sort of struggling, making mistakes, feeling those mistakes, reaching again. You're actually constructing faster, more fluent circuits in your brain, which translates to faster and more fluent performances. You know, we are absolutely terrible as parents, as coaches, at judging talents, but we still are compelled to do it. We sort of have this urge to look at every six-year-old and say, there's a genius, there's an average kid, there's a terrible kid. And what we're learning is that we are so bad at doing that, we should absolutely stop trying. In other sports, like football, like baseball, they measure people at the ages of 18 and 20, and they measure them in every conceivable way, with psychological tests, with physical tests, and they still manage to get it wrong most of the time. You know, the MVPs of both the American and the National League were low draft choices this year. The best quarterbacks in history were very low draft choices. They were not identified even at that late age. And yet, because of the culture, I think, of certain sports, and I would put tennis among them, there is this tradition of analyzing very young people for their skills and making decisions and sorting them, which is quite a signal to those kids, and sorting them into different piles. But the science is showing us, I think, this is really, truly the wrong thing to do. Real talent, real performance, real fluent, beautiful talent, no matter what it is, takes a tremendous amount of time to grow, and it takes a huge amount of what I would call sort of the intangible qualities, the emotional control that you see in a championship performance, the kind of grit and resilience that you see in the training, in the learning of those sorts of skills that get enacted every day, not just one time, but every single day for years. And it's the same story we see over and over again. It's incredibly hard to identify good performance at a young age. We will always be surprised, I think, by who ends up performing. And so the best thing we can do as parents and as a culture, I think, in a sport is create something. I mean, you used the word pathway in the beginning of this conversation. I think that's a really important word. You know, you need to build the pathway. You need to sort of behave in a way that doesn't constantly sort and judge kids, provide them with the best individualized coaching, and basically sort of follow the blueprint that exists in other places for growing talented people.
Well, one of the things that kept jumping out at me in your book is this whole idea of these talent hotbeds. And the U.S. used to be a talent hotbed for tennis. Recently, mm-hmm. we have been, you know, kind of shaking our heads and throwing our hands up and saying, what the heck is wrong with us that we can't develop these tennis champions anymore? Our kids are too soft. That's the problem. We need to imitate other countries' coaching methods. That's our problem. Maybe we're not identifying these talented athletes young enough. Let's start even younger and allocate resources that way. Do you think that a national governing body is really capable of identifying and developing talent?
You know, I don't. I don't. I think it's much more organic, free range than that. I think those are the sorts of things that do succeed, and you see it across, you know, not just tennis, but other sports in other countries. It's incredibly difficult, and it's not because they're not, and you don't have enough expertise. It's that I don't think anybody can really successfully do that in a top-down way. You know, talent is a very, very complicated process, and to have someone swoop in when the kids are very young.
Oh, Daniel, we lost you. I'm hoping you're going to call right back in. You dropped off the show. But for those of you listening, I'm going to go to a quick commercial while we wait for Daniel to join us again. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, we're back, and I think Daniel's back on the line. Dan, are you here?
I am. I'm sorry about that, Lisa. Some text. I think the USTA was bugging the line or something like that.
Could be. So you were talking about, you know, the whole fallacy of the top-down approach and started to elaborate.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a very, very difficult thing because it's incredibly difficult to make those types of judgments. And the other thing about that is the act of making that judgment is a very powerful signal. And there's some great experiments by a Stanford psychologist named Dr. Carol Dweck on some of this. But when you tell a kid that they are a genius, when you tell a kid that they have natural ability, you diminish that kid's ability to take risks. And now risk is at the very center of getting better. You need to operate on the edge of your ability constantly to build faster, fluent skills. And when you send that signal, you are a special, different kid than everybody else. those people will become naturally, instinctively, much more conservative with their risk-taking, which is why being a prodigy, and especially being identified to the world as a prodigy, is an incredibly terrifying experience. You know, if that gift came magically, it could leave magically. Why would you risk that status? You should behave, logic determines you would behave more conservatively. So praising kids for their effort, not for being magical geniuses, is a much more powerful way to create performance. And I think the psychology of that is one of the reasons why identifying small kids and their families as special will automatically reduce their willingness to take risks, to be tough, to be emotionally resilient, not because the kid is getting soft, but because that's the signal you're sending them. So that's yet another reason why I think bottom-up beats top-down every time.
I love that. Another thing that you touched on in the Talent Code is you talked about the hotbed of literature in London during Shakespeare's day and how there was this cluster of writers. And you also touched on a similar thing that happened in Florence, Italy, with the artists. And I kept reading that, and I kept thinking, okay, that's really awesome for the people coming up behind, that they were surrounded by this cluster of amazing brains and gifts. But how did that cluster come to be in the first place? I mean, we used to have that here in the U.S. with our tennis, and that cluster seems to have kind of faded away. How do we get it back?
Yeah, well, I think you're part of the thing. These types of conversations may be the things that help. I mean, let's be honest, these types of clusters like the Renaissance and like the one we talked about with writers in London are the product of these vast historical forces. You know, in the case of the writers, it was the development of these very dense cities. It was the development of plays. It was development of having theaters where these people could earn a living doing this. It was development of bars and pubs where these people could collide with each other, and the density of that proximity really helped a lot. In the case of Italy, they had this sort of apprenticeship system where you could bring in young people, and they had rich people ready to pay for it. So in some ways, it has to do with kind of the landscape that's out there. How do you reignite that? I think the key person in this equation is somebody who gets overlooked a lot in your particular sport, and that's the individual tennis coach. What I saw when I visited Spartak in Russia was the way that the position of the coach in the culture is incredibly high. It's sort of equivalent to, the position of a CEO in a company or the position of the great professor at a university. They are not just sort of appreciated. They are revered. And they're trained in a way with a formality. You get a degree in tennis if you're in Russia. They're formally trained. They're revered. And it's not – I think in the U.S. you have more of a parent-centric culture where the parent is a shopper trying to – as a consumer choosing between the best coach and picking the one that makes them feel the best at that moment, whereas in Russia and some of these other countries, the authority really lies with the coach. And what I've seen from my research is that these talent hotbeds, many of them can begin with one great coach and one promising player. That relationship, that two-person relationship, is very powerful. And if one person can succeed, as Anna Kournikova did in Spartak, that one person can succeed, can really ignite a talent hotbed, because they sort of fill the windshield of all the kids around them. You know, you can talk about promise all you want, but nothing is more powerful than having somebody succeed from your neighborhood, from your street. When you can look down the street and say, oh, that 13-year-old girl down the street that I used to, you know, that I used to see playing hide and seek is on the Olympic team. That is more powerful than anything. So if you can create through a single great coach, through a single promising athlete, someone to fill the windshield of everyone around them, and really give them someone to stare at and someone to emulate and someone to model themselves after, it's sort of the single most powerful thing that you find it's sort of the nuclear reaction at the center of all these hotbeds. That one breakthrough performer is an incredibly powerful thing, in making the most of that breakthrough performer. Capitalizing on it in sort of an organic way. And I've seen hotbeds. It's funny, there's a hotbed in table tennis that started exactly this way in California. There's one coach from India who had a few good players and got a warehouse and all of a sudden put all this stuff together, and pretty soon there are Olympians coming out of this place. So being alert to that, seeking out those coaches and seeking out those athletes. And it starts with kind of a culture that doesn't treat coaches as a commodity, but as the most powerful resource there is. A great coach makes all the difference.
Absolutely. So for parents, then, how do we identify those coaches? Are there some telltale signs that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, they tend, I mean, as a rule, they tend to be a little older, and they tend to be, I would call them, kind of emotional athletes, very able to form a deep connection. It's that feeling of trust that great coaches can really create. I mean, if you think of the best coach in your life, or any of your listeners think of a coach that made a big difference in their lives, what you remember is the way they make you feel. And that ability to do that is really important. Great coaches also speak in very vivid, concise images. They don't give long inspirational speeches. They give short, vivid information. They behave more like a GPS machine. They establish that link, that bond to the heart, and then they send a lot of very short, vivid instructions that that help somebody build their brain, essentially, and make the right reach. And so those are a few things to look for. And they also tend to be pretty funny, as a rule. Tend to have good senses of humor, because humor is a beautiful tool to connect with people. You don't find many sort of, you know, boring great coaches. They tend to be sort of fascinating, compelling individuals.
Interesting. I loved reading all of your different chapters about the various coaches and the various, not just in sport, but the music teachers and educators. I mean, it just was so inspiring. And it, on the one hand, I read that and I'm filled with this longing to find that, you know, to find that magic confluence of coach and inspirational athlete or musician or whatever, you know, and the parents that surround that. I mean, you talk a lot about this matrix of causes for these hotbeds, and you say that it includes the culture of the area, it includes the coaches, it includes the parents. It sounds like a lot of it is just luck. I mean, just happening to be in the right place at the right time. Is that really what it is, or is there something deeper going on that I'm just not seeing?
Well, there's something a lot deeper going on. I think it goes into the kids' connection to the sport. It's funny. There's which can happen now more than in more and more different ways. One of the tennis places I visited was to watch Robert Lansdorp train a young, about 11-year-old California girl of Chinese descent who was a top player a few years ago, and for all I know remains a top player. But her backhand, it was sort of, it reminded me of somebody. I was watching her hit backhand, and it reminded me, I said, oh, you sort of hit like Roger Federer. And the girl said, yeah, you know, it's funny. He's my favorite player, and I watch him, you know, every day, whenever I can. She had this connection to Federer that you saw in her form. And today is a particularly exciting time to be alive, because you don't have to rely on, oh, geez, I hope I grow up on the right street. You know, I hope I grow up on the right street where there's a slightly older great tennis player on one end and a great coach on the other end. Because thanks to the, you know, internet, we can connect to that. And what that tennis player did, connecting and watching Federer over and over again, putting Federer in her windshield, as it were, is an incredibly powerful way to connect. Because that, you know, in tennis and in other sports, you tend to overlook the fact that the most important thing is, why does a kid love it? You know, why is the kid playing tennis? Are they playing tennis for themselves? Are they playing tennis to be to be a good boy or a good girl for their parents? Are they playing to please the coach? Or do they really deeply love the act of playing? Or do they love that feeling of the ball coming off the racket so much that if they had an empty day, they would go fill it with doing it? Do they have that kind of obsession and that love? And that's sort of the engine at the center of this, too, that gets overlooked. It's not so much about what street you go on or not so much about luck, but it's about creating an environment where that can happen, where you're constantly putting great players in the windshield, whether those great players come through the screen or whether they come through traveling and watching a tournament. But to filling the windshield with sort of great players and coaches to kind of stoke that flame. And that's, I think, something that is more controllable than simply kind of hoping you grow up on the right street. And really appreciating that relationship, appreciating that intensity, and kind of fueling that as much as you can as a parent, and respecting it. If it's not there, it's not there. There's a lot of kids in all sorts of sports that are doing it not for themselves. And when they get the opportunity to quit when they're 16 or 17 or go to college, quitting is the first thing they do because they never really loved it. So at a young age, filling the windshield, increasing the opportunity for that lightning bolt to happen where it's like, oh, my God, this is my identity. I love this. This is who I am. That's the moment that really underlies and fuels, you know, great performance down the line.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I have had people say to me, you don't want your child to identify themselves solely as a tennis player or whatever it is that they're involved in. Their identity needs to be more than that. But from my experience and from the reading I've done, and especially the stuff that I read on your site, it seems that intense identification with the activity has got to be there in order to fuel that child to continue putting in those deep practice sessions and moving forward. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was just actually I was with a Division I NCAA basketball team as a pro scout was visiting. The pro scout was trying to identify which of these players is going to go on and have a good career in the NBA. And the questions that he asked were totally fascinating. They were like, what do you think this guy thinks about off the court? Like, what's he thinking about when he's walking around, when he's in class? And even they were super interested in who his girlfriend was. Like, what's she like? They were interested in all these extra things because they're just trying to get a snapshot of this player's mind. And this is a 21-year-old kid trying to get a snapshot of his mind. How much is he just thinking about getting better, thinking about the game? And it really is, I think, it's not to say that can be his only identity. It's not to say that the world life isn't long and there are a lot of opportunities to evolve. But that sort of obsession where it's like it's always like a little rock in your pocket that you're turning over a bead in your pocket that you're constantly playing with. That's the kind of mentality that that does end up, and it's sort of a productive obsession, whatever you want to call it. But that's the kind of thing that ends up producing, you know, progress and performance. You know, that's not to say, well, that's the only identity they can have. Certainly you find what's interesting to me in looking at successful tennis players is you find a lot of them have a very broad athletic base. They didn't specialize early. You know, Federer didn't specialize early. You know, he played soccer till he was 13, then he got sort of serious about it. So, you know, maybe that's another problem with trying to ID these players really, really early, because having a broad athletic base is, you know, as several studies have shown, is definitely preferable to specializing early. And I guess that goes for specializing your identity as well.
Interesting. One of the things another area that caught my attention was when you were discussing the whole soccer hotbed that is happening and about how these coaches kind of developed this whole subculture around, I don't even know how to say it, is it futsal?
Yeah, football disallow, soccer in the room.
But the smaller court, shorter, you know, smaller ball, all that different kind of facet. And I don't know how much you follow tennis here, but there's a movement in the U.S. right now with 10 and under tennis. It's actually an international movement. It's driven by the ITF, but of bringing players 10 and under up on shorter courts with foam balls, bigger rackets, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, it's being modeled after what's happening in soccer.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think it sounds smart. I mean, there's a beautiful, if your listeners want to check out, there's a beautiful video. Gosh, I think I tweeted about it a while ago, but it was where they took kids, they basically built a soccer field to the same proportion as it feels for a small kid, and they had adult coaches go play on it. So it was just massive soccer field, you know, three times as long, and the goals were three times as high. And the coaches tried to play on it, and it was, you know, they couldn't, they could, you know, hardly cover the goal. It was just massive to them. And it was really a beautiful reminder of, you know, how a learning space needs to be designed to let people function at the edges of their ability. And if full-size tennis courts for such small kids is a difficult thing, to me it makes absolutely perfect sense, and it's certainly echoed in what we're seeing in hockey, you know, much more smaller game, cross-ice stuff for younger players as opposed to playing the full length. But making things the appropriate size for the challenge. I mean, the point, you know, everybody, you can always adjust after you've built the skills. But if you're trying to build the circuitry, if you're trying to get kids to make more shots at the edges of their ability, you know, shrinking the court seems to make make absolutely perfect sense to me. And it certainly has that kind of thing, you know, has had a great deal of success in other sports.
I think one of the big controversies over what tennis is doing is that it's strictly age-based rather than development-based. And so, you know, you have children, obviously, who develop at a faster rate than others and are ready to move on to full-size courts, regular balls and all of that, but they're being held back because they're not the right age yet. And, you know, I'm wondering, what impact can you see that possibly having over the myelin production and the love of the game and everything else as these children move forward in their development?
Yeah, that sounds like a problem worth addressing. Certainly, it's not perfect for everybody, but you know, it speaks to a few things. I mean, one is, you know, individualization. You know, all good talents like this, and I would compare soccer and I would compare tennis to, say, developing the violin. You need to develop really good fundamentals, and you need to be able to repeat that same motion with precision and power every single time. And that type of learning space tends to be a highly individualized one. It's very difficult to teach 10 kids to play the violin at the same time. It's much more easy, and violin tradition has evolved. You have a single teacher and a single learner. That's the kind of individualization that's important, I would say, in a tennis environment. In terms of navigating this miniaturization by age and ability, it seems to me it would be fairly simple to come up with some sort of a standard where you achieve a certain level and then you move on to a certain court, whether you're 6 or 8 or 10 or 14 or whatever. But I think there's this traditional backlash against, oh, it's not a real tennis court. They're not on an official tennis court. They're not really playing tennis. They're playing paddle tennis or something, some different sport. And I think the way to get past that is to realize what you're trying to build is circuitry. You're trying to build the ability to produce this performance, to produce a reliable backhand, to produce reliable volleys, to produce a reliable forehand. And that's inside a kid's brain. I mean, the brain is telling the muscles what to do. So however you decide to do that, you know, when I went to Spark Talk, they taught them to do that by swinging a lot without the ball. Now, that would cause many traditionalists to choke on their soup, you know, this idea that, oh, gosh, you've got to be hitting a ball all the time. Well, actually, no. When you think about it, in terms of building the circuitry to make a proper forehand or backhand, removing the ball is huge. It's actually a very productive and helpful thing to do. It removes all the distraction of where the ball is going to go, where you hit it, and you focus on what really matters, which is getting your body in the right position at the right time. And to do that, they practice swinging in slow motion, which is something that a lot of musicians do. A lot of musicians play very slowly, because it allows you to identify those errors. It allows you to work at the edge of your ability. It allows you to make your brain work faster and better. So this idea that, you know, miniature courts are bad just because they're different is, I think, deeply misplaced. The idea is to align the learning environment with the skill that you want to build. And if the skill that you want to build is reliable forehands and backhands, there are many different ways to do that.
Well, that provides a really good segue into the whole topic of chunking, which to me is fascinating, of breaking down movements or pieces of music or chess moves into their individual components and learning how to then put the components together into bigger and bigger pieces until you have a whole thing put together. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process and what happens in the brain as that process is going forward?
Yeah, that's a beautiful. I think you explained it beautifully. I mean, it's the same way that if you take, you know, yeah, it's very good. Well, when we learn to read, we learn individual letters and we combine those into words. Then we start combining those words into sentences and those sentences into paragraphs and those paragraphs into novels. And you see, it's like this quantum effect. You get this combinatorial explosion of possibilities and of virtuosity that comes from really focusing on A, B, C, D. You know, none of Shakespeare is possible without understanding A, B, C, D. And so chunking, which feels, when you do it, to be sort of simplistic, and you feel like you're suddenly childlike, and it's very basic, and it feels very basic, so we tend to instinctively sort of shy away from it, is in fact one of the most beautiful, powerful things you can do in embracing that. There's so many elements of practice that seem tedious and that seem boring because we think of them as being sort of repetitive and robot-like. But when you realize that every time you make an intensive reach or an intensive repetition, you are changing your brain, you're adding fluency, you're adding speed. It's a construction process. When you embrace that stuff, it's amazing. You can really unlock a lot of performance potential. And a beautiful example of this is, you know, the best quarterback in the world, Peyton Manning. What does he do every day? He practices, if you're watching before a game, he practices taking the snap and pulling the football up to his chest, like just that. And then he'll combine 3 steps back, and then he'll do 5 steps back, and then he'll do 7 steps back. If you look at how Yo-Yo Ma practices the cello, he does these really simple things, playing one single note really well. So all these guys are embracing chunking in a way that is very powerful and very useful, and it's not tedious. And it's not boring, and it's not drudgery. It's construction. They're building their brains to operate fast and fluently, you know, without and it's the best way to do that. So chunking is sort of one of those things that looks boring, but in fact is pretty beautiful.
And do you feel like that is the most effective way for someone to learn a new skill, by building those chunks one little tidbit at a time?
That's a core part of the process, but, you know, the process is bigger than that, and it really begins with the eyes. It really begins with staring at that skill for a long time until you've kind of engraved it, whether it's, you know, Federer's backhand or Tiger Woods' putting style or whatever you might be trying to learn. You know, evolution has really built us to learn through our eyes, and staring over and over at what we want to become is a really powerful way to begin that process. You know, and then you might move toward chunking one bit of it and then chunking the next bit of it and then maybe seeking some guidance and videotaping yourself and getting some feedback. But having a process that sort of starts with the eyes and moves toward chunking and then as you practice, there's a lot of other techniques that, you know, I talk about in the book and in the blog, but, you know, like interleaving your practice, where instead of doing 5 or 10 of the same thing over and over again, you mix it up, which forces you to have a little more control and modulation. You're not just sort of robotically hitting the exact same shot. And you see a lot of these practice techniques in some of the best players who don't necessarily practice the most. You know, there's a tradition, I think, in tennis where I got to go hit 10,000 forehands and 10,000 backhands every day. But when you really look at the practice routines of top players, they're actually a lot more varied. They might be more intense, but for much shorter amounts of time. There's a great video I've got on thetalentcode.com of Djokovic playing this tiny game of tennis where you have to sort of have it, you bounce it over the net. You just played in the service court, and you hit it off your racket, but you have to bounce it almost like it's a ping-pong serve off the ground and over the net. And he's playing against, and it's the most intense thing. It's so demanding and very quick and really fun. Really fun, actually, to play. So a nice example of kind of aligning the learning space with the way your brain learns is that that particular joke of the drill. But yeah, room for a lot of creativity. There's room for a lot of things. But essentially, the process is you stare at it, you start building it piece by piece, and then you design an environment where you can refine it and hone it.
Athlete, is there any point that it's too late for all this? And what I mean is, at some point, does it become futile to keep trying new things and hoping, in hopes of finding success? Or I mean, let's talk about this whole myelin thing and how it's produced. And you are a big proponent of making sure that the kids understand how myelin works and how it's produced. So maybe you can share with us some tips on explaining that to our kids and making sure that our coaches understand it and are talking about it with the kids too, or maybe that's not an important piece. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I've found that it's useful for some kids, it's really useful. They benefit, you know, by having an understanding, oh, this is what practice does. You know, this is how my brain changes and how I build my skills. For some kids, it matters less. But, you know, we all probably remember the term myelin sheath from biology class. You know, it refers to this layer of insulation that's around all the wires of our brain, and it exists for the same reason that, you know, our computer cords and every electrical cord is insulated, because if you don't insulate, the signal will leak out all over the place. But what we did not understand until more recently is that myelin grows, and it grows in response to intensive practice. When you reach and repeat something over and over again, you actually earn a little more insulation. And when you get more layers of insulation, the signal speed goes up. It goes way up. It goes up to 200 miles an hour, and you get much more accuracy. And so they've done, you know, these brain scans where they show the myelin growth in the appropriate amounts of the brain, and, the growth is proportional to the hours spent practicing. So this idea that, or this truth that when we practice on the edge of our ability, when we reach and repeat, we're actually earning that accuracy and earning a little bit more myelin. It can be a very powerful idea. Now, myelin arrives kind of in a wave of the brain from back to front, from kind of motor areas to cognitive areas, which is why you don't find people on the pro tennis tour who started playing tennis when they were 18. You know, the pathway never changes. We're always able to add myelin, but young kids are especially able to add it. It arrives very quickly for them. So, yeah, there are these sort of windows where if you don't have certain things, it's very difficult to go back and get them. And the other reason it's difficult is because, you know, our habits are very hard to break. Those are sort of made of myelin too. So if you have bad habits, it's hard to go back and you have to sort of go back and rebuild a habit. But, you know, we're constantly surprised, I think, in most lines of work by late bloomers, you know, constantly. So the idea that you can say, well, at age 16, there's no chance that they'll ever succeed, I think that depends on a lot of things. And one of is the sort of what you think success is. You know, if you're talking about being a lifelong player and competing in at a high level that makes you happy, I think there's room for a lot of success. If you're talking about being one of the 0.001 of 0.1% that makes a living playing tennis, then maybe you could say, yeah, if they're not at this level by 17, they should probably consider another pursuit. But we're all built sort of by myelin in a way, and understanding that and appreciating it allows you to sort of leverage it and understand it in a way that I think you can take a little bit of more control over the process. Rather than sort of hoping everything works out and attribute it all to luck, you can have a bit more control.
I like that idea. I like that idea of especially a teenager where so much of their life is out of their control, feeling that they can own the control over what's happening in their practice and what's happening inside their brain. Because as we know, I forgot to ask you how old your kids are. I know you've got four of them. How old, what's the age range?
18, 15, 13, and 11.
So you're right there with the teenage brains, and, you know, so you get it. it's a crazy time for our kids, and I always feel so badly when I see frustration happening, and I'm not just in my child, but, you know, in the ones that he hangs out with too. You know, so much of their life is out of their control, and I think anything we can do as parents to give them some semblance of ownership over at least part of their life is a positive thing.
It's true. And there was, I just came across something that you made me think of. There's a group of coaches who gave seminars all over the country for more than a decade, and they decided to ask the grown athletes of, you know, these kids who are now in college. They said, what was the most useful thing, most fulfilling, most sort of impactful thing your parents ever said to you? And what they came up with was great. It was when their parents said, I love to watch you play.
Yeah. Actually, I published that study and had the author of the study was on the show a few weeks ago. So I love that too.
Fantastic. No, you're on it then. I mean, it's to me, that was just a real useful reminder of what this is really about. You know, it's easy as a parent to get as feels out of control as your kid sometimes does.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting. I one of my listeners actually emailed me a question that I wanted to put forth to you. He noted that you say that the best time to practice or give feedback is oftentimes immediately after a performance, which makes a ton of sense. But a couple weeks ago, I had Coach Wayne Bryan on the show, and he's, if you're not familiar with Wayne, he's the dad of Bob and Mike Bryan, who are our champion doubles players in this country, and they're phenomenal guys. And one of the things that Wayne said is that right after a match, don't talk to your kids about their performance. Just ask them, you know, whether they want a Gatorade or a bottle of water and where they want to go eat. And So given that tennis players really are usually so tired and emotionally drained right after a match, especially if they've lost the match, what do you think is the best approach for a parent to give feedback?
I agree with the Brian's approach as a parent. I mean, it's different if the parent is the coach. I think that's a different. I think this is about the role, really, you're playing. You're trying to play the role of the parent, I think it's where do you want to go for pizza? Super supportive. If your job, if you are Richard Williams or Tiger Woods' dad or something like that, and you really are in the role of the coach, I think, you know, it's important to use that opportunity, you know, to be a coach. But as a parent, that's not really your job in a way. I mean, maybe more your job is to, you know, see if your kid can come up with their own system for evaluating that stuff. It's really about self-evaluation. It's not about giving a report card to your parents after a match, but it's about having a system in place where when you cool off and after the emotion is away and you've had time to recover, where you can, while that match is still fresh in your mind, sort of systematically go back for yourself and say, what went right, what went wrong, and what's my plan to do something about that? Empowering a kid with some kind of checklist or system or, you know, this is why keeping a performance journal is such an effective tool, can really, you know, allow, free up a parent to have the Gatorade conversation instead of the backhand conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I do think it's important for the kids to take ownership of that as well, but you know, I think it's in our DNA as parents to, as soon as they come off the court or off the field or off the stage, to say, wow, you did that great, but you really should have done blah, blah, blah a little bit better. And I, you know, that's when I think our kids shut down, and why that study that came out was so important about, you know, these college players, these college athletes saying, I just want you to tell me you liked watching me. That's all I want to hear.
Can't you relate to that? I mean, yeah, I mean, it's your mom or your dad, and they're coming off, and all of a sudden they're giving you all this advice. I mean, come on, don't do it. You know? So, yeah, I think I love that. I love that study, too, and it really puts you in their shoes and what it feels like to give everything. And it all is about ownership. You know, it's all about ownership. These kids that do sort of show young promise and then and become the center of their whole family's life. I mean, no wonder a lot of them quit, because they were never doing it for themselves. They were always doing it for someone else.
Yeah, that's true. All right, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. We're winding down. We've got about 10 minutes left. And one of my favorite parts of the Talent Code was the section where you talked about the KIPP schools and the success that this format is having around the country now. It started in Houston, I believe, and expanded to New York, and now these schools exist everywhere. And again, for my listeners, if you haven't read The Talent Code, please pick it up and dig in, because there's such interesting stuff in there. But one of the things that you talk about is when you went to visit the KIPP school and you met with the students, that there was almost a kind of scripted interaction that the students mm-hmm. took on with the visitors, and how you kind of picked up on that and you weren't really sure what to make of it. To me, I interpreted that as a fake it till you make it attitude. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about the importance of that mindset, fake it till you make it, in terms of developing talent.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, and the KIPP, the KIPP culture is very unique, but it's also similar in some ways. And I think it does come down to a question of culture. You know, the signals that they send in that building, the kind of personas that they're trying to create, the kinds of behaviors, it comes down to behaviors. How do you inspire behaviors? And one sort of, and it all, it's like any great culture. If you talk about Apple or Southwest Airlines or Zappos or the Navy SEALs, like when you first walk into them, it all feels kind of corny. You feel like an outsider because everybody's sort of behaving according to a certain set of rules that you're not quite clued into. But that's the way you establish a sense of belonging, and that's the way you establish an identity. And I've since come to really appreciate those types of signals. And one example of a corny sort of signal they give there at KIPP, they will plant a piece of garbage in the cafeteria, and the teachers will watch. They'll just see. And hopefully some kid will notice it and pick it up and throw it away. And they celebrate that as if the kid just threw a touchdown pass in the homecoming game. Like, they celebrate that. They take that moment and they make a huge deal of it. And the kid becomes kind of a hero in that culture. Now, is that kind of cheesy and scripted? It absolutely is. But is that a really powerful way to create value, to create a value system, to create the kind of personality that you want to? And there's a tennis version of this that happens all the time that I remember talking to Robert Lansdorf about. He was always stunned at how many young tennis players did not carry their own bag. These bags are big and they got a bunch of rackets in them, but his point was they got to carry them. That's a really important signal of who's playing, of what this is for, of responsibility, of ownership. Who carries the bag? And in a way, I think of it as that same thing. It's sort of phony and scripted and doesn't seem to matter. But in fact, if you talk about a signal that sends a powerful message about values, about ownership, who carries that bag is a huge, huge signal.
Absolutely. And so how does that tie into kind of that fake it till you make it attitude?
Well, we're built to learn through imitation. We're built to learn by copying. Our identities, we think of our identities as being sort of unfixed or very fixed and unchangeable. But in fact, we're social animals. And so when we're put in a new environment, whether it's a KIPP school or a tennis academy or whatever, we'll start mirroring. We'll start getting in concordance with the people around us. And so that idea of sort of fake it till you make it is sort of the way that we're built, in order we will respond to those sorts of signals. And it speaks to the importance of the culture in any given tennis hotbed, the culture in any academy, the culture in any family, because that's really the way we're built to change and the way our personalities are built to sort of respond to the personalities of the people around us. And so if it feels like you're faking it until you're making it, I mean, that's one way to think of it. The other way is to think about it in sort of synchronicity, getting yourself in synchronicity with those around you and making sure that those around you are headed where you want to go.
Right. So interesting. I'm now like sitting here picturing in my brain, walking into different environments that I go in each day, whether it's a business or a leisure activity or whatever. And, I can see now I'm going to be looking for these little cultural things that are going on. And one that jumps out, living in Atlanta, Chick-fil-A, is huge here. And we always laugh in our family because there's a thing at Chick-fil-A that whoever serves you, whenever you thank them for something, they always say, "My pleasure." That's their automatic response. And, you know, and we go through the Chick-fil-A drive-thru, I'm embarrassed to admit, how many times a week, and every time they hand us the bag of food, it's, you know, we say, "Thank you, my pleasure." And, you know, we immediately turn to each other and go, "My pleasure." It's become kind of a joke, but it ties right in with what you're saying about creating that culture. And, you know, it'll be interesting to kind of tune into that a little harder and see what kind of signals I pick up along the way. But, all right. So in our last few minutes, I really want to get back to the coaches, because that's another piece that jumped out at me in a lot of your writing, is the importance of the early coach and knowing when it's time to move to the next level of coach and how to identify the appropriate coaching relationship for our children. Can you help us through that?
Yeah, I know. The science sort of shows that there are two types of coaches, two species of coaches, you might say, with a lot of sort of talent and development and a lot of talented people. You sort of have the first coach, who's kind of the warm and fuzzy coach who makes you love it, who really connects you to the fun of the act of doing it, and also the work ethic that you need to practice. The piano teacher who gives you the piece of chocolate at the end of every lesson is kind of a cliche. But it's a very real cliche, because those are the people who are close to you and who connect you to the joy of what you're doing. And then usually at the age of 13 or so, whether it's music, whether it's sports, it's a moment where you either become more serious or not. And that's kind of the step-up moment where you do find coaches show up with more rigor, with more discipline, with more expertise, where you might seek out the best coach in your state, and that really can have a huge impact. There aren't that many of those people. There tend to be a lot of the first kind of coach, and there tend to be fewer of the second kind of coach. And so that tends to be the evolution, where things get more serious around the age of 13, when, you know, hormones are flowing and choices are being made of what kind of person you want to be. And if someone does kind of identify intensely and say, "No, look, this is who I am. I'm really willing to invest myself in this," that can be a very powerful coach to have at that level. To me, it kind of speaks to the fact that I think both of these kind of coaches are undervalued. And, you know, when somebody gets up and thanks the people who made it possible, I think. You know, we tend to instinctively overlook the power of having someone like that in your life, who's not your parent, who makes you love it, who pushes you to be someone that you didn't know you could become.
And so is there a trick to identifying that second type of coach, since they are rare in our communities?
Well, they tend to be older. They tend to be I think typically they're identified by results. You know, they're identified by, okay, who worked with those other great players? That's, I think, sort of the quickest and the shortest. And then if you've got a choice between a bunch of them, I think you look for the person where there is some chemistry, you know, between the student and the teacher, where they're able to find that connection. And most of these type of coaches they tend to be choosy. You know, they're not looking to teach everybody who walks through the door. They're looking to find some really connected spark. And it's not always with the best player, but it can be with someone who says, you know, where they sense, "Oh, this is somebody I can really go somewhere with."
Well, that's great advice. And we're down to our last minute, and I'm so sad because I still have a whole list of questions for you. But I'm so kind of enthralled with this whole idea of talent and where it comes from in these hotbeds and what's happened, especially in the U.S. in recent years with our, you know, talent culture around tennis, and finding the hotbeds again and helping our tennis community kind of get back to where we were is something that I'm really watching. And I think that by reading information like you have, not just in your books, but also on your website, is kind of a crucial piece. And I hope that our coaches are paying attention. I hope that other parents are paying attention, and certainly hope that our national governing body is paying attention to what it's going to take to get us back off the court. So do you have any departing words of wisdom for us, Dan?
Well, it's not a factory, it's a garden. You know, you can't build a talent factory, but you can plant a lot of seeds as a parent, as a coach, and you can be attentive to the kinds of conditions where those seeds are going to grow. To me, that's the first real step, is understanding this process and understanding and to be humble about it. You know, we can't just sort of think, oh, I've got the answer, I can just apply this, you know, throw this money at it and apply it and it'll all work out. That's not how the world is built.
That's a very good point. Well, thank you again for spending time with us this week. And to those of you listening, I hope you'll share Daniel's wisdom with your friends that are involved in tennis and anything where their child is pursuing excellence. I think he's got some great advice for all of us. I appreciate your time so much and look forward to your next blog post. For those of you who want to read Dan's blog, it's danielcoyle.com, right?
That's
talentcode.com. And there is a link on Parenting Aces, so if you don't have a pen to write it down, just go to our links page and you'll find it. But there is a link to your blog on the talentcode.com, and I have been posting like crazy links to your blog post over the last few weeks because you've had so much good stuff. So please take a look, you guys, and let's all work together to help our kids be the best they can be and to be the best supportive parents we can be in the meantime. And I think the world will be a much better place. So have a great week. Thanks again, Dan, and I look forward to joining y'all next week with another great guest.
Thank you, Lisa. My pleasure.
Thank you again. Bye, everybody.